call again. Okay?
Absolutely.
So my intention is just to have a lot of fun and to totally connect with all of our listeners from the level of the heart, and with Richard from the level of the heart, and just with my questions be able to bring out the best in him, which is going to be super easy because I haven't heard anything but the best of him since talking, since it's just so completely connected, since Richard's so completely connected to himself. What's yours?
My intention is that everyone who listens to this call is able to really deeply appreciate what a phenomenal individual Richard is and how his passions have really led him on to phenomenal success with just the means of him being open to taking his life where those things took led him, wherever they led him.
And you know what? Oh, excuse me. I've got one other question, one other intention, too, and that is that the listeners who are new to these calls get so completely filled up with knowledge and inspiration that they have that they immediately go and sign up for our future calls, because future Passions of Real Life Legends series, because we've got such great people, and they'll, you know, be able to get such great knowledge from these wonderful guests such as John Gray, which we have coming up, and Yehuda Berg and Neil Donald Walsh and just so many other great, great legends. So I don't want anybody to miss out on them. They're just so wonderful.
Great.
So has anyone joined us this morning?
Or this evening, as the case may be.
Yeah, this evening for you and this morning for me. This is fun calling from this far away.
I'm online from Baltimore, Maryland.
Hi, welcome. What was your name?
I'm Farlo Blixlick, calling from Baltimore, Maryland.
Hi, Farlo. Welcome.
Thanks.
How did
Hi,
you do
Farlo.
About the
good,
calls tonight,
good evening.
Farlo.
How are you?
Well, thanks. It's fun
so,
to listen to you all set your intentions.
Pardon me?
Fun to listen to you all voice your intentions. I'm glad I called early.
Good.
Well, you know what? I'm so glad you were happy and having fun to listen to us, because everybody's going to get to listen to you that here's our archive. So can you please give us your intention for the call? How about that?
My intentions
for passing the hat.
My intentions are to be an empty vessel so that I can really take in everything that's being shared.
Wonderful.
Oh, and thank you so much. And you know what? When you speak your intention when there's many people on the line, your intention is also for everyone. So thank you. That was a beautiful, beautiful intention. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Wonderful to have you with us this evening.
Great.
Who else is on the call with us tonight that would like to introduce themselves? Well, we have a...
You know,
So, Janet, I think maybe you should tell our listeners a little bit about what the experience is like going from the United States to Europe to India. In
okay, so for those of you that got on early, and I just want you to know, I think I probably got up earlier than you, unless you're calling from where? Would it be Australia, I think, huh? That would beat me out in Japan, if I'm not incorrect with my timing, but I'm a right-brainer, so forgive me if I'm not quite on, but it's about 5:28 for me this morning, a.m. I'm in Bombay, India, and I'll tell you, Bombay, India never sleeps. So when I wake up, it seems like half the world when I look out the window is awake, Chris, because, you know, there's no change. You look out the window and there's traffic here. And Bombay is called the city that never sleeps. And it's probably about 80 degrees out. And remember what it was like in July when we were coming here and we looked up on the weather and it said smoke? and that was the weather condition. Well, I can tell you the weather condition now would say clear and lovely, because it's just been wonderful being here this last week.
Great.
So it's really, really wonderful to wake up this morning in wonderful Bombay, India, and to share the weather with the listeners.
I
heard some more people come on.
Well, Janet, I think it's time for us to begin, so I'm going to go ahead and welcome everyone tonight to this Passions of Real Life Legends call. This is the continuing series where Healthy, Wealthy, and Wise magazine allows you to spend time with people who are legends in their own field. Those of you who are subscribers, you know that you will be receiving a recording of tonight's call and also a transcript. You'll also, in 2 weeks, on October 26th, we'll be interviewing Hale Dwatson, the president and CEO of Sedona Training Associates, and I know all of you will want to be listening to that call as well. Now, any of you who are not yet subscribers to the Passions of Real Life Legends series, you absolutely want to be sure and do that. For tonight's call and the call in 2 weeks with Hale Dwoskin, you will be able to receive the recording and the transcript, plus receive Healthy, Wealthy, and Wise's library of over 70 e-books for the introductory cost of just $4.95. So you can hardly not take advantage of that, I know. And on an ongoing basis, it's just $14.95 a month to be able to listen to these calls with people like Jay Abraham, Dr. John Gray, the author of Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, Rabbi Yehuda Berg of the Kabbalah Center, the spiritual guide of Madonna, Demi Moore, Ashton Kutcher, and thousands of others, Neil Donald Walsh, the author of Conversations with God, and many, many others. Remember, as a subscriber, you receive not only this call, you get to listen to the call itself, but also receive a recording, a transcript, as well as a special gift from the individual who we're interviewing to introduce you to their work and allow you to go in more depth beyond what we just cover in the call itself. Again, the focus of these calls is to not just talk with these amazing, legendary individuals in about their work, and we certainly will do that, but also to go inside and to ask them to share with all of us what it's like to live life aligned with your passions. What are the obstacles, the challenges that come up in doing that, and how did they overcome those passions? What role does passion play in their lives? So these are very special calls, and we look forward to having you with us tonight and every 2 weeks on an ongoing basis. I also want to make one other quick announcement that for the authors who are with us tonight, and I know there are many of you who are listening to this call because we have a very special author, a legendary author, as our guest this evening, but you will want to know that the National Speakers Association in Northern California is sponsoring a special Authors Day on November 6th. So those of you that are in California or on the West Coast, you'll want to be able to take advantage of that. And you can do that by going to www.nsanc.org. Again, that's www.n is in Nancy, S is in Sam, A is in Apple, N is in Nancy, C is in Charlie.org. And I guess I should also tell you, those of you who are not yet subscribers to Healthy, Wealthy, and Wise's Passion series, to subscribe to that series so that you do get the recordings and transcripts of these calls, you will want to go to www.healthywealthynwise.com. That's healthy, wealthy, the letter N, wise.com. And then click on step number 3. And for just $4.95, that you'll be able to get the recording and transcripts of this call and the call in 2 weeks. And then on a monthly basis, as you continue your subscription, be able to receive those calls for all of the great legends that will be interviewed in coming months. It's now my great pleasure to introduce to you the author of The Passion Test, Discovering Your Personal Secrets to Living a Life on Fire, the cover editor of Healthy, Wealthy, and Wise, and the inspiration behind this series. Those of you who have not yet taken The Passion Test yourself, you absolutely will want to do that by going to thepassiontest.com. Again, thepassiontest.com. Tonight, your host is my business partner, an amazing, brilliant woman, and calling in this evening from Bombay, India, to introduce and interview our special guest tonight. Janet, are you there?
Yes, I am, and I already got cut off in wonderful India style, Chris, so I want you to know I'm on my other line, so if you can also call me in a second. Everyone, I want you to know that it's a real test of all of our flexibility when I call from around the world, so be with me, because, you know, life is about being flexible. And so here we go. So when I hear the phone ring, I'm just going to hit the other line. But good morning to everyone that's in Bombay, India with me. Good early afternoon to anyone else who's listening from other parts of the world, and good evening to all of you in the United States. This is Janet Atwood, again, calling from Bombay, India. If I get cut off, Chris, you can take over with a question, and I will get back on. So you'll all know we're just playing this dance of taking it as it comes, and welcome to our world. I'm so excited to introduce tonight to everyone just a wonderful, wonderful person, a great, great author. Speaking to him, preparing for this call, was probably one of my favorite moments of the year. And I'm just so honored to introduce to you tonight Richard Paul Evans. Richard, are you with us?
I'm here. Hi.
Oh, great. Hi. How are you?
Good.
Here I am.
Yeah,
I'm so happy I made it, I tell you. There's a whole story to it, but I won't take the time. I'd like to introduce you first if I can, and then we'll start with some questions. Is that okay with you?
Wonderful.
Great. Thank you. And so happy you're here. When Richard wrote, just one second, here we go.
Hello?
Chris?
Janet, go ahead.
Hello.
Go ahead, Janet.
Hi. I'm sorry, everyone. This will not happen again, because I know I can't hang up on you. So, Richard, you with me?
I'm here.
Did we hear a little bit of a stop in the whole call?
Yes.
So I'm going to start all over. So I apologize. Here we go. When Richard wrote number one bestseller, The Christmas Box, he never intended on becoming an internationally known author. Officially, he was an advertising executive, an award-winning clay animator for the American and Japanese markets, a candidate for state legislature, and most importantly, husband and father. His quiet story of parental love and the true meaning of Christmas made history when it became simultaneously the number one hardcover and paperback book in the nation. Since then, more than 8 million copies, 8 million of The Christmas Box have been printed. During the spring of 1997, Richard's Christmas Box Foundation, which we'll be talking about later, started the idea for the Christmas Box House, a shelter for abused and neglected children. As an acclaimed speaker, Richard has shared the podium with such notable personalities as President George W. Bush, President George and Barbara Bush, former President, Prime Minister John Majors, Ron Howard, Elizabeth Dole, Deepak Chopra, Steve Allen, Bob Hope, and more. He's been featured on the Today Show, Entertainment Tonight, as well as in Time, Newsweek, People, The New York Times, Washington Post, Good Housekeeping, USA Today, TV Guide, Reader's Digest, and Family Circle. Richard lives in Salt Lake City, Utah, with his wife, Carrie, and their five children. His latest book, which we'll be talking more about later on, is called Five Lessons a Millionaire Taught Me. Please welcome with me Richard Paul Evans, a real-life publishing legend. Welcome, Richard, and forgive me for the very interesting bleep in the beginning.
Oh,
how you doing tonight?
Good, and I'm impressed you made it through. We lived in Italy for 2 years, and We had nothing but problems, so you're doing well.
Well, thank you. And if for a minute you go, Janet, do you have another question? I want Chris will fill in for me, okay?
Okay.
If it blanks out again, because this is the first from our international calls. So let me start asking you some of these questions that I put together this early morning, so we can get started. In this series, we're particularly interested in examining how following one's passion, the things you love the most, contribute to a person's success. Will you tell everyone how it was that the things you love the most led to your writing the story of the Christmas box?
Of course. You know, a while ago, I was on a radio show with a woman, and she had been a kind of an icon in the community and had the number one radio show in a very large city, and she disappeared for a while, and I understood that she had actually just taken the bar and had done a job as a lawyer, and I was impressed that she had done that. And then the next year I came back on book tour, and she was back on the show, and I said, you went to law school and then gave it up? She said, well, it was something you wrote. She said, I wasn't happy, and I was reading through one of your books, and it said, without passion, we are condemned to mediocrity. And so she, I think that's where it all started with me. We need to do things with passion. When I first wrote The Christmas Box, I felt this tremendous love for my children, and it was something that was brand new in a way. It was I didn't necessarily want to have children, and when I made that decision, I didn't know how it would affect my life, and it opened up so many doors and changed my life in so many ways that when I wrote The Christmas Box, I wanted to somehow capture that. I wanted to share with people the joy that comes from the service of raising children. And so that's...
Well, didn't you write it at first? Because I was reading something that you had written it as an expression of the love for your two daughters.
Exactly. And that's exactly what it was. It wasn't a book that was to be published or to spread around the world. I wanted to capture that feeling so that someday when they held their own child in their arms, that they could then think of and understand how I felt about them as a father. And so initially, my whole idea was to make two copies of the book. One for
Jenna. So you never had an idea that you would publish this book to begin with?
No, that was outside of making a little copy to put under the Christmas tree, that was it. So
it went from two to what?
Well, what happened when I finished the book, and anyone who's written a book knows that all of a sudden you want, you know, I was so moved by the experience. I was so changed by it, and it was such a spiritual experience for me that I ended up with a book that was much more powerful than I ever dreamed of writing. And so I wanted to share with people. So I gave a copy to my wife, Carrie, and she was so moved by it. I started to share it with some family and friends. I decided I'm going to, rather than doing two copies, I'm going to do 20 copies.
Yes.
And we're going to do this as Christmas presents. So that's what we started doing. I went out, I made 20 copies, and handed them out as Christmas presents. And that's where it all started.
And then from there, those 20 copies, what? I think I read that about around more than 160 times they were
exactly.
Spread around.
Yes.
And then the word spread so widely that now this was what was so amazing, that from those 20 copies being spread around, bookstores started calling you. Is that true?
Exactly. I was receiving phone calls almost every single day from people reading the book. I knew it had transcended my circle when I started receiving calls from people who I did not know. And I remember a woman calling and said, Mr. Evans, I just want to tell you what your book means to me. And I asked, who are you? She gave me her name. I said, where did you get my book? She said, from so-and-so. And I asked, who's that? So I realized the book had been passed on. It was about 6 weeks after I gave those books out as Christmas presents that I received a phone call from a local bookstore. And the clerk just said, hello, Mr. Evans, did you write a Christmas story? And I said, yes. And she said, oh, good. She said, where can we order it? Well, you can't order it. The book's never been published. And she said, well, I've had 10 orders for that book this week. And so...
Oh, my gosh. That's a miracle. That's what you call support of nature. You know, when you're really so aligned, would you not agree with me with what you're supposed to be doing, that nature just takes over and opens all the doors?
Exactly. I've always maintained that this book had its own life and its own mission, and I felt more dragged along with it, because I would give the book just kind of enough to do what it needed to do to get to the next level, and then it would take off, and so it actually made it easy for me, because I think so many people start with, well, how am I going to sell a million copies of my book, or how will I hit the bestseller list? I was happy with every level of success. I was thrilled with instead of two copies, I had 20 copies. So
this leads me to my next question, because many of our readers are aspiring authors themselves. So would you share with us some of the secrets which allowed your book to become a number one New York Times bestseller?
Well, absolutely. And I think something that's important is we talked earlier, and we talked about it being unusual for a self-published book to go to the top of the list, and what was it that allowed the Christmas Box to achieve that. And what I'd like to do is kind of combine these two questions. The first thing to remember that's most important about the book is that it was the book. And I remember, what was it, two election cycles ago when someone said, it's the economy, stupid. And it's like, you know, it's the book, stupid. It's the book was special. I have not been able to duplicate, even though I've become a more savvy marketer, I have not been able to duplicate the success of the Christmas Box since. You know, none of my books, even though they've all been New York Times bestsellers, none have sold at that level, which is you know, Harry Potter level and above. So,
right.
So when I started, the first thing I realized is that because I was passionate about it, I actually had an advantage as being self-published. When you work with a larger publisher, you know, it's a business, and they're good at what they do. But they're going to put out more than 100 different books and just see who, you know, which ones get saluted. And so they throw it out there. If it doesn't work right off, then they'll probably drop it. And so as a self-published book, I cared a lot about it. And so I was willing to go to bat for the book. This was after I saw that the book was indeed powerful. I had this belief. I had a belief of destiny with the book. I had a belief that if people just read it, then they would change. And that's what I found. I remember the first time I met Jack Canfield and Mark Victor Hansen. I was at my very first book show. Chicken Soup for the Soul was just taking off. And he still talks about this I know Jack does in his seminars today. He remembers the first time he saw me, I'm standing next to a mountain of books. My idea was, I'm going to go there, give away 5,000 copies of my book. Because I believe that if 5,000 people read my book, that they would take it out and spread it, and it would become a number one bestseller. And so the first thing was to get the book into people's hands and let them read it. I started to practice what I call guerrilla marketing. I know there's now a book about that, but I was calling it back before the book. It's like, okay, if I can't win the big war against the big publishers, how can I win? Well, if not a big fish, at least a medium-sized fish in a small pond. I can win in the little markets. And so I would go to little cities that no one cared about, and I would get on the radio. And they were looking for something to talk about, and I could tell them about my book. And what we found that every time I began to learn what people were connecting with in the book. I learned why they liked the book and what affected them and why they wanted to share the book. And so what happened when I learned those things, I got to the point where I would go on these radio interviews. And my distributor could actually track me around the country, because every time I would go on a radio interview, they would get four or five calls from bookstores in that city looking for the book. And so I learned how to talk about my book. It's crucial. And when you talk about your book, and how did I learn this? Kind of in the same way. I don't know if you've studied the life of Ronald Reagan at all, but in the early days when he was he signed a contract with I believe it was General Motors. And what he didn't realize is that he had to speak constantly. He was giving speeches every single day, in fact, sometimes two or three a day. And he hated to speak, and he wasn't very good at it. People would walk out on him, and But what happened is because he did so much of it, he decided, I'm going to get good at this. He started to work very hard at getting good at it, and he became what to be known throughout history as one of the great communicator. Well, it took practice. My first interviews with the Christmas Box weren't very good. But what I did, they weren't interviews on radio. They were talking to people at book signings. People would come up and say, well, what is this? And what I learned is first I'd tell people about the book, they'd walk away. They weren't that interested. And then, you know, one day I came across something and they said, oh, that sounds interesting. I'll buy the book. Okay, I was learning. And so I'd find another thing. And what I learned is that near the end, that more than half the time, if someone talked to me, they would buy the book. And so I learned what sold the book. I learned how to speak about it. And I was able to talk from a level of passion. I mean, if I didn't care about the book, it never would have happened. But they saw that passion coming through me, and they wanted to share that. And so they would buy the book. And then what would happen next is after they would buy the book, they would read it, they'd come back and buy more because they wanted to share those messages. And so the growth of the book was exponential. But it really was a sense of guerrilla marketing. I started in little cities. I got it out wherever I could. And what was interesting is that the book was a bestseller in Grassroots America before it hit the New York Times. In fact, when it hit number two on the New York Times, it was a function of it growing so quickly, no one in New York had heard of the book. And so when all of a sudden this book without a publisher shows up at number two from nowhere to number two on the New York Times, it stunned everyone. And at that point, you know, my whole world just exploded. I'm getting calls and movie offers and everyone from Spielberg's company to the top publishing houses in the world.
Well, and Richard, you know, one of the things that I'm hearing listening to you is that you were so passionate about the book that you went out and started doing things even though you didn't necessarily know what to do or what to say in the beginning.
Oh, I knew nothing. I knew nothing about the industry. In fact, I think anytime you're following your passion, you're going to be tested. And maybe these are the true, not to be confused with your passion test, Janet, but there are things that test how much we really care about something. And I was at a book show, the Mountain and Plains Book Show in Colorado. I didn't have a lot of money. And I took all the money I had and put it towards marketing. And so I went to this book show, and I'm there handing out copies of my book and meeting bookstore owners. Well, what we found at the show is that no one was coming through the main area where the booths were. And here I had spent a sizable portion of my very meager budget to be at the show, and I was frustrated. And so I finally went up and asked someone who was walking through. I said, where is everyone? There are thousands of people here. How come there's no one in the hall? And they said, well, because they're out with the authors. And I walked out, and sure enough, what would happen? The publishers would bring in some of the top authors in America, and they would give away free books. So these bookstore owners would stand in line, and they'd walk through these lines, get all these books for free, autographed. Then they'd go and get back in line and wait for the next slug of authors to come through. So
yeah.
I'm sitting out here watching this happen and watching my dreams vanish because I'm a nobody. You know, no one cares that I'm at the show. No one knows who I am, and here are famous authors. And so I'm sitting there watching, all of a sudden I had this thought. I looked up at the table where these authors are, and there was an empty seat. And I thought, what is to stop me from, besides security and the people at the show, from just walking up there and sitting up there with the authors? And I looked at it, and I'm shy. I was like, no, there is no way. I turned around, started to walk away, and I had a stack of my books with me because I had thought maybe I could go hand them in the line. And I started to walk away, and then it just hit me. How much do you care about this book? And that was just one of those gut-honest moments when it's like, well, I care a lot. And then if you don't do it, who will? And I just, you know, I bit my tongue, and I turned around. It's like, I'm doing it. I'm doing it. I can't believe I'm doing this. And I walked up around the back. I came through the curtain, and I sat down between two best-selling authors. And I sat down at this table absolutely terrified, and the worst thing that could have happened did, one of the organizers, of course, immediately spotted me. The woman walks over to me, and right when she gets me, I looked up, and I said, sorry, I'm late. And the woman was stunned, and she looked at me for a moment, kind of blinked, and then she said, may I get you some water? And I said, well, sure. So I sat there and I finished out this whole long line of people coming through, sitting next to best-selling authors, signing my books, and I accomplished what I needed to accomplish for my book. The next year I came back as the number one best-selling author in the country and at that show. I was the featured author at the entire show. People were in line to see me. And
that woman who gave you the water?
She was there.
Was she there?
She was there. She's been there every year. And I walked up and I said, "Do you remember me, perchance?" And she smiled.
Oh, that is so great.
And she said, "Yes, I do." She said, "Good for you." And I said, "Thank you for not throwing me out." She said, "Honestly, I was going to. That's my job. I was walking over to tell you to leave. And when you looked up and I saw the earnestness in your eyes, I thought, what is it going to hurt? You know, here is someone chasing his dream, as crazy as he may be. It's like, it's not going to hurt anyone to let him sit here and give away his book." So she got me water instead of throwing me out. And look how it came back to bless both of us. But that to me was one of those gut check moments when, did I really have passion? And so when people say, "Oh, you're so lucky," it's like, no, you have no idea. I was willing to fight for this book. I was willing to do uncomfortable things. I was willing to take chances. I was willing to risk everything for this book. And when you have that kind of passion, fate just favors the bold. You know, it's just all of a sudden things will start. You'll struggle and you'll fight, but you will win.
Yeah, and have you noticed about things that you don't have that passion for, and maybe even some of your other writing, that you don't have as much chutzpah to get yourself out there and do the things that you've done for this book? Have you noticed that?
You know, I notice it all the time. It's like if I don't have that energy, in fact, I didn't write a book this year for that very reason. I just didn't have the passion for it. I'm pushing along, and it's like, okay, it's sounding okay. It's, you know, I'm sure it'll be a bestseller. And it's like, you know what, I don't really want to do this. And finally, I just called my agent and said, no book this year. It's like I owe it to my readers. And I owe it to myself to be honest about my feelings. And I think it comes through in the writing. So this is the first year in 10 years that I didn't write a book.
Because you know if you do what? If you went ahead and wrote a book without that feeling,
mediocrity.
I mean, it's so obvious, but let's hear it anyway.
It's mediocrity.
It may
succeed just because once you build up a core of readers, and I have hundreds of thousands, once you have that, it's very glacier-like. And I think if I put out a mediocre book, I think I would lose some of those readers, but because of all the passion in the past, it would still carry it for a little while, but it would diminish. I would diminish, and I didn't want to diminish. You know, I didn't want that to happen. The thing is, how could I promote a book? How could I talk about a book passionately if I knew in my heart that I hadn't been passionate about writing it?
It's so true. And now you've got stories from all your experiences, like standing in line, which I heard both Jack and Mark Victor Hansen tell when you weren't around about you in different audiences, to write even more, you know, when you do, you know, when you want to come up with more passion. Your passions lead you to more passions. Haven't you also seen that?
That's true. That's true, because, they we'll talk about it later, but it led me to the Christmas Box House, which is my new passion and dream.
I do want to get to that. But first, let me ask you this, since we're on this little run. Were there any obstacles along the way? I mean, this was your passion. I hear that you said that, you know, you didn't have the, you know, you were shy. You were a shy guy. You had put yourself out there. Were there any other obstacles that you experienced along the way, and how did you overcome them? I also heard you say that you had to, you know, put out all your money to buy those 5,000 books, which is good for you. I want to tell you that in my mind, I see all of our authors online now will probably be at the BEA next year with their own booth and 5,000 books, right? So thank you for sharing that. But were there any other things that you had to overcome, and how did your, what role did your passions play in helping you overcome them?
Well, this is important to understand, and if you remember nothing else from our discussion tonight, remember this. we do not succeed in spite of our obstacles and challenges. We succeed precisely because of them. I'm going to repeat that. We do not succeed in spite of our obstacles and challenges. We succeed precisely because of them. I had a discussion with the woman who edited the Christmas box. She charged me $75 to edit this book. And I mean, that's how small it was. And I went back and I gave her several thousand dollars to thank her after the book became a bestseller. And she said, I have watched you over the last 3 years, and it's amazing because everything you did seemed to hit an obstacle and fell. She said, I don't know how this happened. It's like your book was built on failure. And I said, it was. I was turned down by every publisher I took it to. I was turned down by the distributors. When I got into the national market, I was turned down by all the TV. It's like everything went wrong over and over and over. It's what had to happen. Because when it finally got to that level, when it could take off, the story wasn't what is the Christmas box about. Except for those who read it, the press did not care about that. When I'm on the Today Show with Katie Kirk, she asked me as a side note, what is the book about anyway? I mean, that was how small it was. What she wanted to know, and what Time Magazine and Newsweek and New York Times and Wall Street Journal, what they're talking about is this guy was rejected from every publisher he went to. He had no publisher, he had no experience, and he beat the publishing world. That's what became the story. And that's what fueled it into the hyper-selling levels it hit. And so the failures I went through, the obstacles, were precisely what I needed. They gave me the ability to succeed. And so to ask, you know, did I hit any obstacles? I hit obstacles every day. I felt like every time I did something, it failed. It seemed like it was a constant humiliation. And so when it hit that, by the time it hit the level of success, I just thought, this is amazing. What an amazing lesson about life.
Yeah. Well, also, what I'm getting, though, too, is that when you finally hit that success, you hit that success pretty well on target with a lot of humility as well. Is that not right? Through all the lessons that you had to go through.
Well, absolutely. I think even more than humility was honesty. I look back with gratitude that things really could have turned the other way. There were things that could have fell, that could have stopped me. Even though People Magazine decided to do an article on me, and then they decided not to. And it was in that moment that was my last hope, and I'm on the verge of losing everything, that I realized that this is beyond me. And it was in that moment that the night that I realized this isn't my book, it's up to greater powers and let it be, it was at that moment that an editor in the middle of the night changed his mind and felt this need to run a full-page story on the Christmas box in the next issue available. So I went from being rejected by the magazine to, you are in the magazine next week. And that just exploded it. Even though it had been a local bestseller, to get it national, it took that kind of power. And so when People Magazine did the article, the day after the article came out, I received a phone call from the Today Show, and the book just explodes. And, you know, we sold out of 500,000 copies in about 2 weeks. And all across America, people are looking for this little book. So that's what
I love your whole story. I love the whole experience you went through, and it was all about just growing, wasn't it? I mean, the bottom line, wasn't it?
Yeah,
becoming more of Richard.
It was. It was. There was a process, and I mean, you have to understand that. I mean, I was a platinum member with Delta. I mean, I fly so much. I've been all around the world. This year I've spoken in Portugal. I came in from New York last night. I mean, I travel all around the world. My book's all around the world. I was afraid of not so much of flying, but of actually being outside of Salt Lake City. I remember the first time standing in an airport in Texas, and I was terrified. I mean, I was afraid of all this. This is, I was, you know, basically pretty ethnocentric. And so it was about growth. I had to reach outside of my level of comfort over and over and over in order for the book to become an international bestseller.
I am so thankful. This is just, I'm just so thankful to you for sharing this story. I mean, what I hear is, you know, what I got from it was, number one, you had to have the love. You had to have the passion. You had to have the passion so you could, like, completely go to that, you know, full tilt boogie, believe in the destiny of it, have the belief in the people, you know, that they'll read it. So you went out and you bought those 5,000 books and handed them out. And then what I heard you say was, you know, you actually, from doing all the radio shows in all these little cities, you started to hear, you know, what they needed, what they wanted to know. And then the last thing, though, that I really thought was profound that you just said a minute ago was that, you know, with the People magazine experience that you went through, was that you experienced that surrender. That you know, and I heard that over and over again, that there was that surrender, having to let go, keep going, but let go, keep going and let go. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes. And
that was more or less the rhythm of that role.
That's such a hard thing for insecure people like myself. It's a difficult thing because you want to control everything. The more insecure you are, the more you want to control. And so to get to that point where you say, you know, I can't do any more. I've done everything I can, and just leave it up to God. That is a powerful moment. It's a very difficult moment, and even though I understand that principle, I still fight it.
Still.
Yeah. So even with the book I'm working on now, The Five Lessons, I go through this again. I mean, I've come full circle where this year I'm actually self-publishing again for the first time in a decade. And I forgot how much work it was.
Now, you've been kind enough, Richard, to share an excerpt with subscribers of that book, The Five Lessons a Millionaire Taught You. It's actually called The Five Lessons a Millionaire Taught Me. But could you talk about how those lessons came into play as you saw the Christmas box taking off? And
well, actually, the lessons took place even earlier.
Mm.
And this is something that... and I believe we have an excerpt to give away to your readers. Is that
yes,
right?
Yes, uh-huh. That's right.
The book, The Five Lessons a Millionaire Taught Me About Life and Wealth, is an accumulation of some lessons I received at the age of 12. And when I was 12 years old, my father, who's a builder, had broken both of his legs in an accident, and he fell through a stairwell. And with 8 children and no insurance, we were just financially decimated. We just lost everything. I slept on. We moved all 10 of us into a 3-bedroom duplex. I slept on the floor outside the kitchen for 2 years. It was a tough time. And I, at that time, a very wealthy man by the name of, and I know it's kind of ironic during the election, his name is Kerry Hines, spelled the same way like John Kerry and the Hines his wife. It's anyway, no relation. Anyway, a very wealthy man. Invited all the youth in the area to a lecture about money, and it changed my life. I attended that lecture, and it changed me, and it affected me in a very, very powerful way. And so I started to live those lessons, and what it did for me in terms of helping the Christmas box is that not only did it put me in a place financially to be able to self-publish the book, but it also taught me to recognize when I had something that was special. The Christmas box wasn't my first project I had done on the side of my business. It was actually my 14th. And so,
wow.
You know, people say, oh, you're lucky. Well, I am lucky. I'm lucky in so many ways. I'm lucky I can see. I'm lucky that I was taught to, you know, read as a child. But in terms of how lucky I was with the success of this book, you know, I think if you tried something 13 times and failed, people don't think of you as being lucky. And at the 14th time you get it right, I mean, if you failed your bar exams 13 times before you passed, people wouldn't think you're like a real lucky or a real smart person. Well, the Christmas box was my 14th project. And because I had learned to watch and to know when something was special. And that's what I try to get to our authors that are listening. If you have a book that, you know, the people around you say, oh, it's great, and they're going to tell you it's great because they don't want you to hate them. But you need to really be honest and just watch how people are responding. If they're calling you for copies and their friends are calling you for copies, then you might have something. And that takes a lot of honesty. But I saw that with my book, The Christmas Box. I'm receiving phone calls from strangers asking for copies. Bookstores are calling me asking for copies. That's where all the lessons I learned pulled together to teach me how to make this work, how to succeed financially with this book. Because a Christmas Box, if I had not been able to have some money to publish it and the wisdom of how to use it and push it as far as I could, it just couldn't have happened.
Before Janet goes on with the questions, Richard, I just want to mention for our listeners, and I'll mention this again at the end of the call, this book, Richard's book, The Five Lessons a Millionaire Taught Me About Life and Wealth, which encapsulates these key principles that Richard's talking about, can be obtained by going to the website, www.thefivelessons.com, thefivelessons.com. So, Janet,
thanks,
did you want to go ahead?
Yeah. Sure. You know, the angel statue in your book has become a rallying point for many parents who have lost children, and I understand that angel statues have now been established in, 54 cities around the world?
That's
and
right.
I think you said there are more than 50 more statues that are coming up very, very soon and then more in the future. Can you, you know, talk more about that and tell us the story of the angel statues?
Well, this is one of the beautiful things with the Christmas box. At the heart of the book is there is an angel statue. It's where a woman goes to grieve her lost child. The angel statue in the book actually did exist at one time. It was destroyed probably about 15, 20 years ago, you know, in some flooding up in the Salt Lake City Cemetery. Well, after the book became a bestseller, locally, people start looking for the angel. They all wanted to see it. Well, we couldn't find it. And the elderly woman who told me about the angel, I had actually never seen it, but I went up there to see it with her. And that's when we found out it was gone, had been destroyed. And so I had an angel statue made. And I thought this would be a place, because so many people who were looking for the angel were people who had suffered losses themselves. And this is one of the things I learned about the Christmas box, that the book touched a chord with people who had lost children. I have not lost a child. And to me, the book was about not losing a childhood. It was about spending our time and our priorities correctly to value our children and to value childhood. And so when all of a sudden I'm hearing from people who had lost children that the book had healed them and had a healing power and that they wanted to find the angel, I decided to have the angel rebuilt. And it was just, again, it was something I did just because I thought it was the right thing to do. I took the early profits from the book and put it in there to build it. And I thought, why don't we every year before Christmas hold a little ceremony for people who have lost children, and it might help them. And what I didn't understand is the level that it would help them. The angel has become a mecca, so to speak. People come from around the world to see the angel statue. I went there the other day. I was having some personal troubles. I went there to meditate, and I sat there, a car pulled up. And four people got out, and they walked by the angel, and finally a man looked over and he goes, you're him, aren't you?
Oh.
And said yes. He said,
oh,
just want to say thank you, sir. And I, every time I go up to the angel statue, there are people are there. They come from all over the world. Well, about 4 years after the first angel statue was established, we began hearing from people in other states who wanted angels of their own. And so at first we helped them a little bit. We gave them the name and phone number of the sculptor, and we told them they could use whatever we had that, you know, to make their own. Well, it started to grow. And now there are 54 angel statues. There are more than 80 more in the works. It is growing faster and faster. Some of these monuments are huge. I know the one in downtown Milwaukee was more than $250,000 to build their monument. their entire parks called Christmas Box Angel Parks or Angel of Hope Parks. It's really fascinating. But to also understand that this from this little book, that it has a spinoff that every year tens of thousands of people are visiting these angels. And on every December 6th, that's the night that we get together, on every December 6th, people gather at these angel statues. And so if your listeners want to know more about the angels, if there's one in their area or if one's coming, or to even see what they look like, they can go to my website, which is just my name, richardpaulevans.com, and pull it up and look at it and see what the angel looks like and find the nearest angel in their area.
Great. So if there's an angel in their city, then it would be listed there?
Yes.
Great. Wonderful.
Yeah, I think it should be updated. They're happening so fast now, if we could be a couple behind. But.
Oh, you've just got these beautiful stories, and this is, again, I know, your passion. So, again, you know, what you've really dropped into and what you really became aware of, and it started with the Christmas box, I would say, was just really following that inner feeling, that gut, that love, that heart. Is that correct?
That's right.
Yeah, so beautiful. Right. Thank you so much. And, Chris, give me a call. So I'd like to ask you the other question about your Christmas Box Houses International, which I told you when we were talking before that I am really behind. That's another result of your book. And can you share with all of our listeners how the houses came about and what your plans are for them?
Well, the Christmas Box House is probably what I would call my latest passion. It's a thing that keeps me up at night thinking about it. And it's just, the size of it to me is daunting. After the Christmas box took off, we were concerned, and I say we, my wife Carrie and I, we were concerned about how the money might affect our family, and that it might that having a lot of money might negatively affect our children, which would be a horrible irony since the book was written for our children. And so we decided that we would teach our children how to use the money to make a better world. And so we decided, not knowing anything about child advocacy, that we would find out what children, abused children, needed most, how we could help them. And so we just started asking questions. And we ended up at the University of Utah Graduate School of Social Work, and we asked the dean, what's the most important thing we can do for these kids? And we focused everything on the one question. What is the most important thing we can do to help these abused children? And his answer was, I don't know. I said, well, if you don't know, who knows? And he said, well, let's invite everyone who knows anything about it and let's hold a conference. And we got together at a conference, and what we learned was that three things. First of all, that these people didn't like each other, that they were competing for the same funds, and so they saw each other's competition. Second, that they didn't communicate with each other because of that. And third, that they all agreed on what needed to happen. And that's where the concept of a Christmas box house was born. We created this facility. It's very large. It was the first facility was $2.7 million. And we learned a lot from it. We made every mistake possible. And it grew from there. We got smarter with all of our mistakes. When, by the time we built our last facility, we built it for less than half the cost. It's just as effective. And we have housed more than 15,000 abused children since we opened. We are now moving into other countries, and we are now getting calls from all around the world from people to help them establish Christmas box houses in their area. My greatest passion right now, tied in with this concept, is that I have this dream of creating an army of child advocates, an army 50,000 strong. I believe we can create an army with 50,000 people who care about children and want to stop abuse and want to help these children in need. And so we did a little test, and we started what we called a Christmas Box Club. And the first one we did in Salt Lake City, and it grew too fast. And we had to abandon the project because it was growing so fast, we weren't ready for it. That was 3 years ago. We studied it. We plotted better, and we just started them again, and they're growing very quickly. We're about to open our third club, and eventually we expect to have hundreds of clubs around America with tens of thousands of members who are going to help these children in their community.
Well, now, how do our listeners become a member?
Well, in most cases, they would probably be starting groups in their area if they're interested. And they can start in very tiny cities. A woman called me. She's from, I don't know if you saw the movie Napoleon Dynamite. Preston, it takes place in Preston, Idaho. And a woman from Preston, Idaho said, this is a tiny, tiny town, but we've got a problem. How can we start a club here? So she's attended our meetings, and she's getting ready to start a club. Doesn't matter how small your town or how big. They can go to our website.
Great. My next question. Okay.
In fact, let me do something. I don't know if this is wise, but I can give you let me give you another website, my personal website. If someone is interested in being involved, they can email me at author, AUTHOR, at richardpaulevans.com.
No, this is your personal email address.
That's my personal email address.
Okay, everybody, you just got Richard's personal email address. So, so what's your intention this morning for how many people would sign up? Let's put a number to this so we can really put it out there.
If we had 50 people say they wanted to start one in their area, that would be as much as we could handle at this point.
Really? Okay, so it's going to have to be, how about we say the first 50, huh?
Yeah.
Okay, first 50. There you go. And then you'll delete after that?
Yeah, and let me give you an example of what a woman did.
Okay.
She wanted to help. She didn't know how. She just knew she wanted to do something. And, you know, desire is everything. Passion is everything. She didn't know what to do. She didn't have the knowledge, but she had the desire. And so she got her friends together, and there were 8 of them. She said, let's start something called Let's Do Holiday Lunch. And we'll get together, and we'll charge an extra $10 over lunch, and whatever money is extra, we'll put toward a charity. We'll put towards a Christmas box house. Well, you know, 8 women, $80. Not much, right?
Right.
Well, it grows. Last year, they maxed out at 500 people and had to turn away more than 100 people. It's now the event to go to in northern Utah. It's a huge holiday lunch. They raise about $20,000 to $25,000 a year for us. And that just shows how this one woman, and she loves it. It's her life. She goes, I have women begging me to come to my lunch. She said, it's sad, but we have to turn people away. It's so big. Well, she started with just 8 women. You know, I tell people, when we first started the Christmas Box Club in Salt Lake City, I said, there's 6 people here. Well, bear something in mind. When Chairman Mao decided he wanted to conquer the largest population in the world, China, there were 6 men. Just 6 men started that. It's like you have to understand the power of small groups that have passion. And that is exactly what I said. Well, that little club has doubled in size every month. Every time we've met, it went from 6 to 12 to 24. And I said, you know, the day will come when we don't fit in any of these rooms, when there's 300 members, 500 members. It's going to keep growing. The other club we have started with 60, and they doubled in 1 month. And so these things grow very quickly.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, for those, you know, those listeners who are interested in being involved and making a difference in their community and becoming part of this huge army we're going to build, I think it's a very exciting thing. You know, it's going to be life-changing for them.
Okay, so I want you to put me at the top of the list because I told you already I'm there, okay?
Okay.
I want to be one of these, and I'm really sincere about that. So write my name down.
All right.
Okay, you got your first one, right?
Okay.
Because my computer's not in Bombay, India right now with me. So let me ask you something. Or actually what I was thinking before I want to ask you the next question, because I love that whole story, is that the miracle, I thought of your next book, it could be called The Miracle of Following Your Passions by the and then the second part could be real-life stories from best-selling author. And you could just tell all of these incredible stories because, you know, they're true. They're, all of these things that you're talking about is just about following your passion. But you've got these incredible, huge things that came out of these, you know, first it just started with something for your daughters, a present for your daughters. I mean, it's just so incredible, and how it grew from one passion to another. It's so inspiring. I'm so thankful to be with you again, Richard. I tell you, I get so excited just hearing, so excited and also knowing I'm so aligned with what I'm doing because I'm just realizing that I'm walking in your steps, it seems. So thank you so much. And I'm sure many of our listeners are feeling the same way, so thank you.
It must be so empowering. That's good.
Pardon me?
It must be very empowering. That's good.
Yeah, absolutely. So in my book, The Passion Test, I say we don't have to know how our passions are going to get fulfilled. We just have to get absolutely clear on what they are and be totally committed to their fulfillment. And I hear that that's absolutely where you've been. You know, I think you believe that. Is that true?
You're dead on. The thing is, like, to get to where I was with the Christmas Box House, a year ago, it was actually 2 years ago, I was on a radio station in Minnesota, and they had some children killed in foster care. And so they brought in this specialist, and she had been to Harvard, she had studied, I mean, she was one of the top experts in the country on child advocacy. And I sat there with her and at the desk, and I'm sitting there speaking, and I'm answering questions she couldn't answer. And when it finished, she turned to me, she said, "Where did you study?" She said, "You are the most knowledgeable man on child advocacy I've ever met." And I said, that's very flattering that you would say that. I just learned from doing it. She said, "Because I love this." And she was just astounded. She said, "You have the answers." I said, "You know, when you follow your beliefs and your passion, it's like it leads you to there." When I started, I knew nothing about child advocacy. I didn't know how the system worked. I didn't know how a foster child was taken. I knew nothing. I now have experts coming from around the world for us to teach them. That's the power. It's like too many times, and I think Og Mandino said it best. He said, "Experience is overrated and wasted on dead man's bones." It's when you jump in and say, "Listen, I don't have all the answers. In fact, I can't know all the answers from where I'm at. I couldn't possibly have even understood the path I had to follow with the Christmas Box because it was too complex. There were people who had been in the industry their entire life who didn't understand what I learned. What I had to do is just follow that path of faith. If you are committed to the outcome, that is all it takes. I don't know what it's going to take to build an army of 50,000 advocates yet, but I am very clear on what I want. I want an army of 50,000 people, and I have had a vision of it already. I know that the day will come that I will come out on stage and look out over this huge auditorium and see child advocates from around the world, and we are going to be one, and we're going to change the world. And I'm very clear about that. I know exactly what's going to happen. And so how we get there is just going to, you know, it's up to God. It's going to move. But what's cool is that this is the fun part. It's funner I mean, the journey is funner than the destination. I am watching this happen just with the few clubs we have. I had this woman call. Her husband's a very wealthy and well-known cardiologist. She wants to do this. She is so into it. She's the president of the club. And she called me the other day and she said, "I cannot believe the quality of women I am attracting to this club. These are people who are like presidents of other clubs that they want to jump in and be here." She said, they're out there. People want, they believe in this dream. And so if your dream is big enough and clear enough, you can achieve it.
Yeah, and I love what you said just a minute ago, too, about being committed to the outcome. You know, you were committed to how, you know, what you wanted to create, and then you said, and yet it was God or higher power or nature, however people want to think, that really did the mechanics, figured out the mechanics. You didn't have to do that. You just had to know what was it that you loved and be committed to creating that which you loved.
Exactly.
And you had seen it so much in your mind. But, and this is what I feel is so important for everyone to truly understand, because when you've got a vision like you have, I mean, if you thought that you had to figure out, okay, how am I going to, you know, get all these people interested, and what are the channels, and all the different steps that it took, which you knew nothing about and had no education on, do you think that would have stopped you?
Of course, because I had the answer. I had to answer questions that I didn't even. I had to have answers for questions I didn't even know the questions. I could only see as far as the next step. And, you know, whether you're fighting World War II like Winston Churchill, or you're running a campaign to save abused children, it's the same process. You don't know the outcome. You just have to say, never, never, never give up. It's like, I know the outcome I want. And, what, and you know, in Churchill's case, what I want is a free England.
Yeah,
I want my country. And so it's also important that people have, when they build their outcome, that they're very clear. Like, see, I believed I could have the number one book in the world. I look back, and it's like, I was insane. I mean, how could I believe someone who had never written a book, who knew nothing about publishing, fighting the billion-dollar industry, and to say, I want to have the number one book in the world, but I was very clear with my friends who are working with me, this is what I want, this is what we're going to do, and something I did, I went out one day and I bought gold chains, and I gave one to each of them, and I put it on, I said, this is like a handcuff. I said, we are bound together, we are committed, every time you look at that chain, we do not take these chains off until we have the number one book in the world. It's like, if you want it on, and they all accepted the chain. And if you look at the early stuff I did on the Today Show or Time Magazine, I'm always holding the chain in a way to show them at home. I was not wearing it like a normal bracelet. I would slide it over my fingers and hold it in a way that the cameraman never noticed. But they were back home, and they would look, and they would see kind of like Carol Burnett wiggling her ear. It was like I was getting the point across. We created rituals and things around it to remind us we have a goal, and we know what that is.
Okay, now chains are going to be bought out all over the world. That was great. Thank you for that. Now I'm going to buy them all. So that is another beautiful. I love that, the whole thing about ritual. And also what you created in that ritual was team. Together, everyone achieves miracles. But you had all these people along with you creating that same intention. So it wasn't just you with that intention, but people who believed in your book and in you and in your projects and what you're doing. Is that correct?
Absolutely. See, right now I have, like for the Christmas Box House, I have on my board of directors, I have Steve Young, the famous quarterback, VIP of the Super Bowl. His wife's on my board of directors. I have the president of the American Medical Association as on my board of directors. I have the head of DCFS in the state of Utah on a board of directors. I have this amazing board. We have maximum political power in this state, but I have a billionaire on our board. I couldn't get anyone to be on my board. No one wanted to be on my board. And what happened is, like, you light this little tinder and these little twigs, and it starts to grow and grow, where I have very wealthy, powerful people now trying to get on my board. So it's, you know, you don't, again, you start out with a clear vision, and you just take those steps and you see it's open. You know, Emmett Smith trying to run for a touchdown, he doesn't know where he's going to be on the field. But he recognized where he can get to in the next fraction of a second. I can get there, I can get there, I can get there, and all of a sudden he's making progress.
So let me ask you, and you quoted Winston Churchill, and so this is a question for you and for what you thought, think, how you think Winston would have answered this. Even though you had the passion, the love, the commitment, with all these obstacles, would you say, and even now in things you do, that fear shows up? Even with all that you've gone through, that fear sometimes might show up?
Yeah, it can. I mean, it does, but you have to realize that fear is the opposite of faith. And so fear is something that you recognize for what it is, and fear can be empowering, but you don't let it linger. You can't have fear and faith at the same time in your mind, because faith is simply a state of mind. And so fear can help you recognize reality. And that's so that's a service. And that's a good thing. But then when you're ready to move, then you don't take counsel from peer. You let it go. And it's like, okay, I'm going to overcome that. I believe I can do this.
And Winston Churchill, I'm sure, you know, what's that great quote, do the things you fear the most and the death of it is certain. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes. Yeah, the greatest moments I have been through in my life are when I tackle those fears. It's always, you know, slaying those fears, doing something that I was terrified to do, that has always had the biggest payoff in my life.
Yeah, so the point I wanted to make for everyone, and because this is my own experience, is that no matter what success and that I've achieved or that you've achieved, right, there's still that fear that's there. It's just that what I'm recognizing from all of these interviews that I'm doing and also experiencing my own life, and I know Chris would echo this, is that, you know, the fear is there. It's just that you just go forward, right? You just go forward in that faith, and know, you know, that it's going to be okay. And it doesn't mean that there's not really a time, I don't think, when it's not, you know, it's not there. It's there. It's just there less, because each time you realize, you gather more faith. You know that, you know, that you're always invincible. Truly. In this wonderful road that we're taking on life.
Well, you know, one thing that I think is really important in dealing with this, because bad things do happen, and painful things happen, and there are times when we do fail, and especially sometimes that failure is necessary. The key is when you're passionate, that you're passionate in a correct way. There's a Christian hymn that says that I love. It says, like the great in truth the great of old in story, if we fell, we fell with glory. To sit there and say, okay, I'm going to give it a shot. I'm going to try. I may fail, but I would rather die on my feet than running. That to me is the ultimate. That to me is courage. That to me is nobility. That is what it's about. There are times with the Christmas box, like, I may be going down, but I'm going down fighting. Excuse me.
Right, which really brings me to that point of there are no mistakes, there are no failures. I mean, those greatest lessons are the ones that build in us, you know, that invincibleness, that strength, that inner strength. Wouldn't you say so?
Absolutely.
There's nothing lost, only everything gained anyway. Thank you for that.
Well,
you know,
I was in a meeting once with a Christmas box house where everything had gone wrong. We were more than $1.5 million in debt. I had totally tapped out any money I could get. I had mortgaged everything I owned. I mean, financially had put me in jeopardy. And my dad, who was working, he was one of four of us working on this project, said to me, Rick, it's over. He said, the ship's going down. It's time to jump ship. And I said, no, Dad. I said, if this ship goes down, I go down with the ship. I believe in this, and I go down with it. And I walked out, and it was confirmed to me that I was not to give up, that I did not have that choice to give up. And I went out, had T-shirts made, and came back and gave them to the staff that said, failure is not an option. And I said, you wear that until you believe it. Failure is not an option here. I look back now, it's like, see, now we have more than $1 million a year come in. Just come in. People die and give us their entire wills, and we have more money than it takes to run our organization, which is an amazing thing. And it's like I look now, and now it's fun, but it's not as great as it was in those hard times. That's when the real tests were passed.
Boy. These stories, I'm telling you, I see this book. I'm going to keep putting that in your face, because I really do see this book, The Miracle of Following Your Passions. I'm sure you can find a much better title, but I mean, everything you're sharing is just so completely profound. Let me ask you something. Is it okay if I share with our listeners your passions from the Passion Test and talk a little about those?
Sure.
Because I want to ask you if they've changed over time as well. Your five that you came out of from the Passion Test book, when I gave you the Passion Test, was your first one was attunement with God. The second one was a peaceful family life. The third was your fulfilling, satisfying marriage. And I'm sure that included number two. The fourth was the Christmas Box Club Army of Advocates. And the fifth, and I asked you, and I hope this is okay, I asked you, I was saying, because you had put down having, you wanted health, your health to be, perfect health. I said, well, what's more important, perfect health or growth of the Christmas Box health shelters? And you said, Christmas Box health shelters. And I said, And I'd asked you, is that true? You know, I mean, what if you couldn't have perfect health? And you said, well, I'm willing to sacrifice that for this. And, that was a very profound thing for me to hear. I mean, again, what I was hearing was this is full on 100% commitment in every way, in every way.
I guess there's a martyr somewhere inside of me, and it's like a great man once said, He said, our lives are to be worn out in the service of mankind. And it's like at the end of the day, it's like, your shoes just need to be worn out. And in fact, this man said, my life is like my shoes. I want to die finished and used up. And I thought that was noble. And you made me think when you asked that question, because it's like, well, what if my health stops me? What if, can bad health stop you? And of course it can. So I guess there's some real balance there. And lately I've given that a lot of thought that, maybe I need to be very careful about taking that for granted. But because I tend to overwork when I really care about something and not sleep enough. And that can really backfire. So.
Well, this is an important point. So your passion, would you say your passions have changed over time? I mean, just since I gave you this, it made you think about it more, didn't it? Did it not? About what your passions were. Like, well, wait a minute, maybe my health should be number five so that if I have that perfect health, then I can go longer.
Yeah, you know what? For instance, sometimes we need to put the horse ahead of the cart. And so that can change it. Because I always thought, well, I can sacrifice my health and work and get here. But, if my higher goal is to have peace at home, lately I found myself being very irritable with my wife, and we were getting into fights, and it just wasn't right. It wasn't like us. And then I realized, like, you know what? I suffer from chronic pain in my neck. I have a neck problem, and I have reflux, and I've done nothing about either one of them. And it's because of it I don't sleep at night. And I'm not getting enough sleep, and all of a sudden it's like I'm getting irritable, and I'm ruining those relationships. And so actually, today I sat with my secretary and I said, I've got to put my health higher on the list. I need to take care of myself, or I'm not going to be able to do these things I'm trying to do. So sometimes we do need to put the horse ahead of the cart, even if we only care about the cart.
Well, then I'm very thankful that I gave you the passion test just to put that right out there for
yeah,
you.
Too.
So can I ask you what advice you could give our readers to help them find their passions and create balance in their lives today?
Well, I like your test. In fact, the best advice I could give you is to take your test, because that's the first time I'd ever done that, and it was very revealing to me, and I can't think of a better way of doing that. I certainly don't have a better way of doing that.
So. You just made my day, I want you to know, because this was not a seeding question.
I hope I didn't disappoint you in not giving you my own answer, but seriously, it not only helped me find my passions, it helped me understand how they, how they fit into my life. And we did notice, because we did the two different passion tests, that the word changes.
Yes. Yeah.
The word changes over time, so.
Oh, okay. So then we'll give it to, I have a call with you, in, I think next month. So, when I call you, we'll look at those again. Chris and I, we actually take the test every 6 months at least, because we keep finding that our passions shift and change and grow, and that it's good to stay, in tune with that growth and that shift, because that which you put your attention on grows stronger in your life. So let me ask you this next question. At Healthy, and this is our gift to you, at Healthy, Wealthy, and Wise, we believe strongly in the intention to, you know, really manifest these outcomes. So what is your current most important, well, I think you mentioned it. I want you to mention it just briefly, your most important project. You actually mentioned your intention, but I want you to mention it again so we can really consciously all hold it for you.
What I want to do is to build an army of advocate for abused children. This army would have 50,000 people, probably average about 50 people per club, so we're looking at about 1,000 clubs, and that we would communicate together, not only through internet, but through conferences, and even we're already planning a cruise we're going to go on together to talk about child advocacy and training and how we can make a difference in the world. I think with 50,000 people, we could absolutely shape this world and affect the millions of children who are abused in just in America alone.
And Richard, if some of our listeners and readers want to participate in that, if they want to become some of those advocates, how do they go about doing that?
Again, I gave my personal email,
okay,
which is author@richardpaulevans.com.
Great. Very good.
Oh, boy, you know you're going to probably get, you know, when you put anything out, you get millions of replies. So this is going to be, I want you to email me and tell you what happened with this one, because I'll tell you, I'm following on your coattails of all the things you do. Next BEA, the Booksellers Convention, I'm going to have 10,000 books I'm giving out. I love what you've done. What's the single most important idea you'd like to leave our listeners with that you haven't discussed with me yet or with all of us yet?
Oh, I've discussed all the things that were important. I think we talked about. So, you know, it comes back to me over and over, the idea of adversity, that it is these difficult experiences, and your listeners have difficult experiences in their lives, that give us a chance to shape and to grow. You know what? Now I take it back. There's one more thing. In fact, something we can talk about later. I came across a new talk I started to give, and I call it The Four Laws of Divinity. And it's something that's just formulating right now. It started when I was in Dayton, Ohio. A junior high school teacher asked if I would speak to some of her kids. Well, 200 of them showed up, and then she asked me to speak for 2 hours. It's like, how do you keep 200 junior high school kids interested? And I gave them these ideas, what I call the Four Laws of Divinity, and I was blown away by the effect it had on them. But the first of those laws is to accept the divinity of your life. And that is something that we have not discussed. If you study the history of people who have accomplished great things or powerful things, and I'm even, and excuse the reference, but I just finished a 1,000-page book on Hitler, and he fell into line with these other men and women I was studying who had accomplished remarkable things. You know, he's one of the most influential characters in history. Every one of those people, including Hitler, had a sense of destiny. So whether you want to accomplish good or evil, to have a sense of destiny is the starting point. And without it, I mean, I had a complete sense of destiny with the Christmas box. But Janet, I know you and Chris have a sense of destiny with what you're working with, and with Healthy, Wealthy, and Wise, and the passion test. It's like if you have that sense of destiny, it will lead you where you need to go. And that is the underlying tone of everything we've talked about. Because without it, if you don't believe there's a destiny or a divinity to our lives, then it's all a crapshoot anyway.
I am so with you 100%, and I love that you left all of us with that thought. It's just so what I believe to be true as well, that, you know, to the extent that you're in alignment with what I call God's will for you, you know, which I feel that you can't possibly have a desire, a passion that's not totally in alignment with what God's will for you. You know, who's speaking in your heart or speaking to your heart anyway, right? I mean, that's that higher power. Some people like to say nature. I like to say God speaking to me through my heart, that love, that passion. And that if you follow that, as we've been talking about over and over and over again, that's your destiny.
that's that huge, gigantic field that you get to play on. Would you agree?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, Richard, the, you know, one of the things that we see in your story and in your life, and I just want to tie it back for everyone that's listening, that God was speaking to you as early as when you were 12 years old in the form of a man named Kerry Heinz, as I heard it, and taught you some lessons which have been, from what you've shared, been critical and important to the success that you've enjoyed. And, you know, as Janet and I work with people and give them the passion test, one of the things which is extremely, extremely common is that most people have somewhere in their top five, or if it's not in their top five passions, then in their top 10, to enjoy material abundance in one way or another, to be comfortable, to have great wealth, to have abundance. People may word it in different ways, but many, many people share that. And I want to just bring back to this wonderful book, your latest book, The Five Lessons a Millionaire Taught Me. And again, thank you for sharing an excerpt of that book with our listeners, with our subscribers in particular. And all of those of you who are subscribers will be able to go online to healthywealthyandwise.com and download that excerpt from Richard's book. Any of you who are not yet subscribers, then just for $4.95, you can sign up, go to healthywealthy, the letter N, wise.com, and click on step 3, and you'll be able to get the recording and transcript of this call along with that excerpt from the five lessons. And those of you that want to just go straight and get the book and be able to learn this knowledge from this amazing, incredible man that has been sharing with us tonight, and thank you again, Richard, for taking this time, I want to encourage you to go to Richard's site for this book, which is www.thefivelessons.com. And you can either spell out five or you can put the number five. It works either way. But thefivelessons.com. And I want to also again mention, Richard, for any of those who are interested and what would like to participate with you in this wonderful and amazing project that you have embarked on now and become advocates, to just remind everyone that they can email you at author@richardpaulevans.com, and of course that is your main site for with information about all of your other books as well, richardpaulevans.com. So, Janet, did you want to close?
Oh, Richard, I love you to pieces.
Oh,
what can I say? I mean, just absolutely, you just hit it. You hit a 10 with me on inspiration in every way, and I just know everyone can hear it in your voice. I always like to say that there are certain people that I've been on the phone with over the years or in an audience, and I can't hear something, and that's because I feel like my ears these days will only listen when someone's truly coming from that centered place of really the heart. And everything you speak, it was just, for me, super fluid and easy and comfortable and just hit right home. And it's always that way. You are so congruent. You are so completely aligned. I can feel it in the depth of my heart. And I thank you for you being you. I just thank you so much for you being you. And from all of our hearts, I know, to yours, we, just wish you the greatest, greatest success in every endeavor. And again, count me in and count Chris in. And thank you from the bottom of our hearts a million times over, Richard. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And I'm so excited to start a club in your city. So.
All right.
Yeah, me too. Me too. Right. This is great. So to all of the listeners, thank you for being with us this morning for me in Bombay, India. I hope you'll understand the little bleep that we had in the very beginning when my phone got disconnected. This is what India is all about sometimes. It's about learning how to be extremely flexible, and that's what my experience is here. So thank you again, everyone. Chris, thank you. It's wonderful to be with you, Chris, from this far away. I feel like I'm in the same room with you. So have a great, great day, Richard. Have a great day, Chris, and all of our listeners. all love to all of you, and talk to you real soon. Bye-bye.
Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.